Welcome to CRR Radio from the Vision 2020 Project.
Hi, my name is Ed Camo from the Vision 2020 Project, and thanks for joining us on our podcast, CRR Radio. On today's show, we're going to be talking with Wendy Korotkin about the CRR co-op that they have formed down in Cobb County, Georgia, that is bringing together a number of different organizations in the county to tackle a problem that every jurisdiction across the country is facing today, the opioid crisis. After that, you'll hear a conversation I had with Fred Durso from the National Fire Protection Association about the podcast series they recently produced called The Survivors, that tells about what happens after a tragic fire fades from the headlines, what the impact is on the family, the friends, and the community. And today we're joined by Wendy Korotkin. Wendy, could you take a minute and introduce yourself?
Yeah. Again, my name is Wendy Korotkin. I work for Cobb County Fire and Emergency Services in Marietta, Georgia, and I'm their accreditation manager slash data analyst slash firefighter.
Sounds like you wear a lot of hats there.
Yeah, just a couple.
Okay. I had a little circuitous route to finding Wendy here. Somebody brought her up because of her accreditation activities. But once I started chatting with her a little bit, I was very intrigued with what you're doing down there with the CRR co-op. Could you fill me in a little bit about what you're doing down there?
Yeah, so we identified the need to figure out what we didn't know. So we've been analyzing historical data for a long, long time. And through the accreditation process, we realized that that's only a fraction of the people that have actual risks or emergencies in their lives. So we wanted to figure out a way to get more of our community services involved. So we kind of brainstormed and came up with the idea of gathering other stakeholders in the community that were invested in risk and identifying their data sources, the risks, the programs they provide the community, as well as try to decrease some of the duplication of effort between the groups. That way we can, you know, leverage each other's resources and get a little bit more out of what we have.
What were some of the groups that were involved? Who did you bring into it?
911, animal control, the police department, public health, the fire marshal's office, GIS. We actually have a representative from ESRI that's come to our meetings. Information services. We have not yet had the medical examiner and Department of Family and Child Services yet, but they're invited to the next meeting. The Public Safety Education Division, school district, senior services, animal control. I think that's it.
And you're really just starting this whole thing. So given the fact that you're just kicking it off, that's quite a heavy involvement, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And part of the reason we have such a high volume of people is we're working directly with the Cobb County Safety Village, and they have a lot of deep roots in the community, so they have a lot of contacts, and that's really allowed us to move forward fairly quickly.
Have you started really focusing on any specific areas right now that you're looking at?
So we've had three meetings to date. The first meeting, we had a homework assigned after the meeting, which was just to identify the risks that you perceive for your area of work. Identify the data sets that you have, if you have access or if you don't, and programs already in place. And from there, we had a second meeting, and we asked people to kind of brainstorm on main topics and main concepts and things that were going on that we could all work together on. And the result of that meeting was that a focus would be placed on the opioid crisis and falls slash head injuries, because it can cover everyone from children to senior services area.
And when it comes to fire and emergency services, I mean, obviously they're kind of on the front end of responding to the opioid crisis, but there are a lot of risk reduction efforts that can be made to try to mitigate that. Kind of what are some of the ideas that people are coming up with, or has it even gone that far yet?
It actually has. The idea, there was a pamphlet that was being created before our meeting. Through the meeting, we were able to identify some grant money that the director of the Safety Village knew about, and we were able to print I believe it's 500 copies of that flyer. And then after that's printed, we're going to discuss getting billboard or a bus stop sign. That's still in the works.
And I think what really intrigued me about what you're doing down there is community risk reduction is really all about partnerships, isn't it? I mean, no one agency or organization can do it all on their own. And I think that's probably what you're discovering down there, isn't it?
Absolutely. And we'll be able to touch the people that never call 911.
You know, how are you hoping to do that? You know, through the partnerships, through the avenues they have, you know, to reach out and touch these people?
Yeah, because quite often, especially with the school system or senior services, they visit people all the time and they talk to people all the time. And they will be able to convey messages that we'll never talk to them about these risks. Mm-hmm. But there's an opportunity to talk to people when they're not under pressure or in an emergency situation to make them aware of the risks and benefit of our services.
Now you mentioned GIS is involved. How are you using mapping to as part of this project?
So far, we haven't actually done anything with using mapping for the project, but a couple of the concepts are to, for the fire department specifically, create a shift in how we record specific information. We are working on using Esri as the collector app and using that for our PAD program. So we have a public access defibrillator program here in the county. And instead of just using an Excel spreadsheet or mapping it for our own purposes, we are in the process of implementing an app to use so that the community, if they have one in their business, also have the ability to add their AED. I think that'll help with some community initiative and crowdsourcing. We also are looking at doing similar thing for our pre-plans, and that'll allow the firefighters to use an app instead of having to use drawings.
Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned you kind of came down this road because of accreditation. How did that happen? What was happening in the accreditation world that led you down the CRR path?
So we had always done a risk assessment for the accreditation process, as it's part of the documents required in the standard of cover. But we've always just touched on what's happened. So all the things we know, and then the things that we think could happen, the regular CBRN stuff. So we're looking at weather and potential cyber threats and bioterrorism and all that stuff. But then we were sitting down trying to talk about, well, how are we doing in our education division? And it kind of stemmed from there. I realized that we know what's going on when you call 911, but nationwide, about 10% of the population uses 911. So what about all the people that are going to the emergency room on their own? What about all the kids that use the Safety Village for their education and, you know, they fall off their bike and hit their head and don't have a helmet on, but their mom takes them to the hospital? We don't know anything about those people. We don't know anything about how bad our injuries and incidents actually are. So with a wider sample, we'll be able to target more of the population. A little bit more specifically, we don't get a lot of calls for minor burns, but there might be a problem out there that we're not aware of.
So tell me a little bit about Cobb County. What is your jurisdiction like?
Cobb County is, the county itself is 340 square miles. Cobb County Fire and Emergency Services is responsible for 304 square miles. We have 29 fire stations and about 682 sworn personnel. Most of the population is urban. It's about 700,000 plus. We run about 66,000 calls a year.
So it's pretty early in the process for this whole co-op that you're putting together. So I take it you haven't had enough time to see any sort of results out of it that you can point to or document?
Not specifically with reduction of risk in the community, but there's definitely been an awareness created. The number of people that come to the meetings has increased since we started. We had success when we did a little bit of an exercise. We did an exercise to help identify target groups.
So tell me a little bit about this exercise. What was the exercise about?
The exercise was literally just to brainstorm on how to identify risks, identify an at-risk population. For the departments that have never phrased it as community risk reduction, it was important to get some of the concepts out there. So we sat down in groups, and each group had people from different services. So we didn't sit down with a group of Cobb police or a group full of senior services. We diversified the group. And I just had a single-page questionnaire, and the questions surrounded the who, what, when, where, how, and whys of risk reduction. And we followed through by identifying some intervention methods.
Risk reduction, is this something that was on other people's radar screens, or is this a whole new concept for some of these groups that you're dealing with?
The concept being termed risk reduction was definitely new. Cobb Senior Services has a wide variety of programming, and they've been trying to reduce risk within the senior population, make them aware of everything from medications to, you know, helping them not fall as often and getting them assistance when needed. But as for other groups, risk reduction is pretty new.
And it sounds like they're really jumping on board with it, though, given that the number of people at your meetings are growing each time.
Absolutely. Oh, and I also found out that the Cobb County Police, they dedicated each shift has a group of people dedicated to risk issues.
All right. Well, we've been talking with Wendy Korotkin down in Cobb County, Georgia, about the CRR co-op that they're pulling together. I know that a lot of other places are doing such programs where they're bringing together partnerships because nobody can do it all alone. But I was really intrigued with kind of the path you took there, going, you know, first looking at it through accreditation and then going into pulling all these people together. And it sounds like it's growing exponentially as you're going down there. So kudos to you, Wendy.
Thank you.
Well, Cobb County certainly has taken a creative and strong approach to tackling such a critical problem. And I'll be sure to follow up in a few months to see how it's all going. Incidentally, shortly after recording this podcast, Wendy dropped me a note to let me know that she has left Cobb County and is now working for Boulder Fire Rescue in Colorado, so good luck, Wendy. Next, I had a chance to catch up with Fred Durso from the NFPA, where we talked about the podcast series he produced called The Survivors. It tells about what happened after a terrible fire claimed the lives of two of the Van Dyke's children in Lander, Wyoming. We never really seem to hear about the long-term impact of a fire, especially such a tragic one. And The Survivors is a five-part podcast series that follows what happened with the family. So here's my conversation with Fred Durso from the National Fire Protection Association. Fred, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. So my role at NFPA, I'm communications manager for NFPA's Fire Sprinkler Initiative, and that is an advocacy campaign we started back in 2009. The end goal was to eliminate or help to reduce the results of home fires, the effects of home fires across North America via the adoption of fire sprinkler requirements for all new 1 and 2 family homes.
Okay, so Fred, what was kind of the genesis of the of this podcast project? How did it even come about to be in the first place?
With the Fire Sprinkler Initiative, I was always aware of the stats behind the home fire problem here in America. You know, in each year, what NFPA tells me, we're still seeing 2,500 people die annually from home fires and another 13,000 people that are injured from these tragedies. And, you know, those stats are very important, but they don't really tell you much about the people involved in these tragedies or impacted by these tragedies. So I've always been curious to learn about who are these people, what's their new normal now that their lives have been altered by a tragedy. My colleague here and friend, Kyle McNaught, did approach me and said, what are your thoughts on maybe doing a podcast associated with the Faces of Fire campaign? And honestly, I first said to him, not really that interested. I'm not the type of person to do something because it's popular, and you know, podcasts, as you know, are widely popular these days based on the successes of those podcast storytelling endeavors such as Serial or S-Town, which I've come to love myself. And I told Kyle, I mean, it sounds like a good idea. I just want to make sure if it's done, if we do it, it's done right, and we have the proper sources to sort of really tell the story in a in a good way, in a way that's going to hopefully shape some new dialogue and hopefully raise awareness about the home fire problem here in North America. So we did a little brainstorming session, and more we talked about it, it seemed like the podcast was a really good fit to sort of tell this story of the home fire problem via the story, hopefully, of at least one family. And we hit the jackpot with the sources that we did obtain for this specific podcast. I got alerted to the Van Dyke family via a member of our public education division here. Fika Van Dyke, the father who we had interviewed, attended one of the public education division's summits that they had here earlier this year and shared a story with my colleague. And I thought he had a really phenomenal story to tell of sadly losing two kids in a home fire, he himself being injured from a home fire, his little son being injured in a home fire, and what they have been through since that tragedy to get to a new normal.
What kind of were the logistics? How did you have to go about putting this whole story together?
So I did some preliminary interviews with Fika and the family, got a little bit more about his specific story, what his new normal is like, what his family new normal is like, what they're still struggling with. And then through that, Kyle and I had this great brainstorming session of some of the themes that might emerge from their specific story and how to take their story and make it just a bigger picture of what follows a home fire, what a home fire survivor must endure. So with each episode, through this brainstorming process, we developed sort of this 5-episode guide, which again takes a look at the fire that the family, went through, and takes a look at the family's story, but just takes also just a broader look at what's going on following these specific tragedies. So through this brainstorming process, we developed this more or less this blueprint episodes, or at least topics at that point that we wanted to cover. So burn treatment was one of them. Another episode tackled the emotional healing from a home fire. How do you get past the tragedy, or at least, I don't know if get past is even the right word for it, but how do you get to a better mindset knowing that you've lost two kids in such a horrific manner? We tackled the fire service perspective. And so now Fika, the guy that we interviewed, had joined the fire service following his tragedy as a way to sort of honor the two boys that he had lost in that fire. So we weave in the fire service perspective and take a broader look at the new home environment and why that's sort of a cause for concern for not only firefighters, but just the public in general. And then we also wanted to address the solution, we feel is the solution to this problem, which is the inclusion of fire sprinklers in all new homes, some of the advocacy efforts around getting those requirements passed across the country. And then the next step was just to go and do some interviews out with the family out there in Lander, Wyoming.
How long did it take you to put once you did all your brainstorming and everything and you started recording, how long was the whole process from recording to actual production?
It was, longer than we thought it was going to be. So we initially, I think, started the interview process back in, I believe it was July. And then following all the interviews, we had to then listen to, countless hours of audio and then read through all the transcripts of that specific audio. That took a lot of time. And then sort of take all that audio, all those transcripts, and then put it cohesively into a story, then write the scripts for all 5 episodes. And then do any sort of follow-up interviews that we wanted to get with the family or anyone else that we interviewed for that story. We did it close to, I believe, about like 15 interviews for this specific podcast itself. So, and then we launched it in November. So that's, five months, I believe, that we spent on this from recording to production to release.
It's amazing how many hours of tape you obtain and how much you really wind up using out of all of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. There were some really great nuggets that we knew the minute we heard them that it would work for this specific story. Even just how the family discussed with just gut-wrenching detail the day the fire occurred and what they went through and how they tried to save their two boys in that fire, for me was just really hard to hear. but I feel like it was something that we needed to include because it does showcase what a fire home fire survivor endures. You know, they have these long-lasting memories that they can't get past, and they're horrific, and they're something that I don't know if you really hear all that often, but I think it's necessary to hear some of the horrors of fire that are out there. So there were definitely nuggets of our interviews with the family that we knew we had to include. And then I was telling that story in a cohesive way. So there was just, a lot of weeding through some of the audio, which also took a lot of time to do, and just, again, put it into a cohesive story as well. So definitely a bit of a learning curve for us as we were doing it.
What's been the reaction to the podcast series?
It's been overwhelmingly positive. I'm getting comments from coworkers here, and I'm getting folks from all departments that have approached me and say how they were really moved by this family story, which means a lot, because we wanted to have people get emotionally involved in the life of the Van Dykes. To hear them have an emotional reaction to this podcast is a phenomenal thing to hear. Even folks that I've always had a hard time, I feel, explaining what I do to my friends and family. The minute I sort of released the podcast to them, they're very interested in listening to it. And this past weekend, I had a discussion at dinner with some friends who are not involved in the fire world or fire service at all, and we're having discussions at dinner over fire safety and their thoughts on the story and how they just got so attached to these characters. And that's something that I've never had experienced before. The bigger reward has just been to share the Van Dyke story in general, and to just have them, this family, very candidly put their life out there and let us into their homes for a few days, and just share everything with us and to tell their story has been, that's probably been the most rewarding aspect of this project.
It's interesting that you mentioned people not involved in the fire service are learning a lot, which is really the audience we need to reach. We're often preaching to the choir, aren't we?
I agree 100%. Yeah. And I hope through this podcast, we are reaching those people that might not, again, be involved in the fire world. And, our goals here are really to help raise awareness of the fire problem, just the frequency and destruction that these tragedies cause, and also just address, as my colleague said in the podcast, the complacency of fire. Well, fire's not going to happen to me. It's someone else's problem. This showcases this, this family, as prepared as they were for it, fire can happen to anybody. It really knows no bounds. So through this, we are hoping to raise, again, just awareness of the fire problem out there and how people can take, simple steps to stay safe at home, as well as the longer look at how to really prevent these tragedies via the increased use and acceptance of sprinklers in new homes, which I think a lot of people still are as a whole, don't really know that this technology is even an option in new homes. They see it everywhere else. They see it in their workplace. They might see it in their hotel. Through the story, I think people are getting now a look at that this can be something that you can include in your new home, and it can have life-saving consequences or effects. It can have life-saving effects.
Well, we've been talking with Fred Durso from NFPA about the podcast series that he just released, The Survivors, that tells the stories of the Van Dykes out there in Lander, Wyoming, and the tragedy they had where they lost two of their children in a fire. And Fred, as I said, excellent job on it. I found it very intriguing. I just downloaded them all and burned right through them all. And I found it just a great story that you told there. So thanks for putting the time into it. And thanks for joining us here on CRR Radio.
Thank you so much. I'd really appreciate it.
Well, I'd like to thank you for joining us on this episode of CRR Radio. I'd like to also take this opportunity to remind you that if you're looking for any tools or resources to help you with your CRR program, please be sure to check out what we have at the Vision 2020 Project's website. We have guides to starting CRR programs, a fire safety materials generator for creating materials you can use on home safety visits, an advocacy toolkit, and a lot more. You can also find all the previous episodes of CRR Radio on our website at strategicfire.org/CRRradio. So, please be sure to subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts so you don't miss a single episode. And thanks for listening, and I'll see you on the next episode of CRR Radio. My name is Ed Camo.
Thanks for joining us on CRR Radio from the Vision 2020 Project. For more information on community risk reduction, please visit us at www.strategicfire.org.